This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips, and the COVID vaccine rollout in Australia has put the spotlight on a part of the healthcare system that's not often in the news.
Gearing up to be part of the rollout.
We're ready to go as soon as possible.
Katie Hayes has done a COVID-19 vaccination training, but so far she's only been giving flu jabs at a Risdon Vale pharmacy.
We're just waiting for the government to change the guidelines to allow us to be able to do that.
National Cabinet decided in April to allow states to use pharmacists for COVID-19 vaccinations. 100 Tasmanian chemists are keen to administer AstraZeneca and Pfizer, but they can't do it without state approval.
On this Rear Vision, we'll take a quick tour of the evolution of the modern pharmacy and discover that the regulation and operation of the Australian chemist is very unusual, possibly even unique. All human communities have ways of treating physical ailments with medicines, whether made from plants, animals, and other things in the natural world, or the chemicals that make up many of the tablets and indeed vaccines in modern Western medicine. These days, in societies like ours, the task of dispensing medication is usually done by a pharmacist or chemist. This job was done for thousands of years in many places by people known as apothecaries.
Well, yes, I mean, pharmacy has its origins many millennia ago with the early civilizations. The Egyptians had people who made medicines, but that was often combined with the role of physician and also priest. So that was often practiced in temples and so on. Well, I'm Stuart Anderson. I'm the Emeritus Professor now in the history of pharmacy in the Centre for the History of Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And the other civilizations, the Romans and the Greeks, of course, had practitioners who were involved in the making and supply of medicines. Certainly in Britain, the business of supplying and obtaining medicines fell to various groups. We call them the spices and the pepperers. Pepperers were mainly wholesalers of medicines coming into the country from elsewhere. And by about the 12th century, certainly in Great Britain, there were a group of people who were specialising in this, and they eventually became apothecaries. The earliest apothecaries, or certainly known by that name, certainly in Britain, are around the 11th century, something like that.
The role of the apothecary shop and the proprietor of the apothecary shop, that is the apothecary, was to provide medicines of a known quality and identity as needed. My name is Greg Higby, and I am the Fischelis Scholar of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy, which is a small historical society for pharmacists located at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So that starts, let's say, 9th century in the Middle East, and this idea then comes into Europe where Islamic culture and Christian culture interface, that is, places like southern Italy and Spain. Then this idea of having an individual who's responsible for medicines and drugs, this idea then spreads up into Europe after 1100, 1200 or so. Islamic culture had trade routes that extended all the way into Southeast Asia for spices and herbs, things that we think of as more culinary. Many of these were also used medicinally. And so these were added to the what was called the materia medica, that is the collection of medicines that a physician might prescribe or a patient might request to treat an ailment. And so the number of drugs increased. And that's where the idea of the apothecary shop comes in. Apothecary comes from the Latin root apotheca, which means storehouse. And so it comes from this idea of a large collection of items. What arises here in the Middle Ages is the need for a shop that would have a specialist who could ensure the quality and the identity of these different drugs.
Let's fast forward now to the Renaissance, when the work of the physician and the apothecary became separated.
The division of labor came about in the Middle Ages and especially the Renaissance in Europe. That is, the physician being in charge of diagnosing and prescribing medicines that the apothecary would then compound and give to patients. That separation really occurs in the Renaissance in continental Europe. It came slower to England and the British Isles in general. It happened in part because it was just advantageous to the physician not to have to be carrying all of this medicine. As you have more and more drugs, it became more and more difficult for a physician, in a sense, to carry these medicines. And you have the development of new drugs that required the use of a laboratory to create them, drugs that we would think of as more chemically based drugs. And with a laboratory, you need, in a sense, someone who is trained in the laboratory science and is able to make these new medicines.
During the 19th century, this separation was ultimately enshrined in law, laying the foundations for the modern pharmacy.
Well, in the 19th century, you started to get more of a division of labor. Physicians started actually writing out prescriptions for apothecaries to compound and dispense. Before, many physicians tended to sell medicines themselves because it was a good source of income, of cash. Physicians often ran a shop themselves, were a doctor within a shop. They actually had a term for them. They called them doctor's shops, where they would be both a physician and an apothecary. But what eventually happened is it became more prevalent for young men who are interested in becoming physicians to go to medical school rather than learning through apprenticeship. And in medical schools, they learned to write out prescriptions rather than dispense themselves. So that's where the division of labor really becomes more common, let's say around 1820 in the United States. And then later on in the Civil War, in the 1860s in the United States, in the military, the division between apothecaries and physicians was very strict, as everything is in the military, of course. And when these men returned back home, the physicians and the apothecaries, they kind of stuck to their own field. They didn't overlap nearly as much. And lastly, I'll say, after the American Civil War in the 1870s, laws were passed by the various states that again clarified the division of labor between physicians and pharmacists.
Well, certainly in Great Britain, we consider the age of modern pharmacy to date from the foundation of the Pharmaceutical Society of Great Britain, which is 1841. Before then, chemists and druggists had very little training. And basically, with the foundation of the Pharmaceutical Society, we see the start of professionalisation. And a key element within that is the ultimate separation from medicine, the medical profession. And in the UK, that dates from 1858, the Medical Act. And that's when we see the gradual process of professionalisation and the development of the kind of pharmacy we see today.
Another key development at the end of the 19th century was the appearance of the department store, which would have surprising repercussions for Britain's pharmacists.
So what we have in the second half of the 19th century is the growth of department stores, Harrods, many, many others, smaller, less well-known ones, which obviously supplied a very wide range of commodities and goods. And some of those decided to install pharmacies, chemist shop, within their stores. One of these was called the London Provincial Surgical Supplies Company. They operated a department store on Tottenham Court Road in London, and they had a pharmacy. It was a big pharmacy. It was managed by a qualified chemist, And it was big enough for him to employ two other qualified chemists. And basically, that company was owned by someone who was not a pharmacist. So the Pharmaceutical Society took him to court. This is 1878. It went right up to the House of Lords. And ultimately, in 1880, the Law Lords decided that actually companies could be treated as persons within the wording of the law. That basically opens the doors to companies to develop chains of pharmacies. And of course, the quickest off the ground really was Jesse Booth, who opened his store in Nottingham. But he's not alone. There's a large number of other retail chains operating. But Booth's had 250 stores within 20 years. By 1900, there were 250 Booth's stores around the country.
You're listening to Radio National's Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. Pharmacies have been in the news lately, becoming significant players in Australia's frantic attempts to quickly roll out COVID vaccines. And this is the moment to explain the unusual laws that apply to chemist shops in Australia. Under government regulation, chemist shops can only be owned by a pharmacist, and location rules limit where they can open up.
You can't just find a great shop front and say, I want to put a pharmacy there. So there are actually lots of rules. It's a highly regulated industry. My name is Rebecca Moles, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Sydney in the Sydney Pharmacy School. In fact, it's very difficult to open up a brand new pharmacy. We have some rules, particularly in New South Wales, where you can't own a pharmacy within a 2 kilometre radius of an existing pharmacy. So when I say own, sorry, you can't open up a new one. Now, people on the call will probably think, but I've seen a pharmacy open up. That doesn't make sense. But maybe they've bought a license from another pharmacy, closed it down and then moved it. But it's very difficult to get a new license to open up a pharmacy. So you'd have to move out the back of Bourke somewhere where there is nothing else in the surrounding few kilometres, and then you might be able to open up a new one. Pharmacy in the 80s didn't have these rules, so these location rules, and in fact, that's why you'll be in many suburbs and you'll say there's a pharmacy sort of on every corner. I used to work in a suburb called Newtown, and I think we had 12 pharmacies at the time in Newtown. But I think the thing is, we do, as consumers, definitely need to go to our pharmacy and have a local pharmacist. But we don't need to have every shop in a row being a pharmacy. So there is some bits of competition there, if you like, and we want to distribute the healthcare around the nation. So it's a bit tricky, and you have to be a pharmacist to own a pharmacy. So you can't go into business with a non-pharmacist. You can't have a pecuniary interest in a pharmacy unless you're a pharmacist.
What about Priceline and Terry White? Are these franchises, just like KFC and McDonald's?
Well, they're actually not franchises. They're buying groups. I'm Stephen Greenwood, and for 14 years I was the Executive Director of the Pharmacy Guild of Australia. After I retired, I wrote the history of the Pharmacy Guild, a book called Ready Prepared, The History of the Pharmacy Guild of Australia from 1928 to 2008. It certainly appears to the public as if they are a franchise, but in fact, they're each individually owned by a pharmacist, and under the laws that operate in each of the states and territories. But it does mean that pharmacists will often pay to, say, Priceline or Terry White, often a lump sum amount, so that the livery, the price details and purchases, bulk purchases, are part of the offering from that particular pharmacy. But they're still, each and every one of those pharmacies is owned by the pharmacist, and they have a right to buy from any particular wholesaler or buy through the, say, the Terry White buying group or the Priceline buying group.
The supermarket giant Woolworths is planning to roll out its own in-store pharmacies. At the moment, only chemists are allowed to sell prescription drugs, but it's a lucrative market, and Woolworths say they've found a way around the law.
The growth of supermarkets has meant the demise of many local butchers, bakeries and greengrocers. Now pharmacies are facing the same fate. Woolworths has unveiled an aggressive strategy to roll out its own pharmacies.
We're going to roll out 100 non-pharmacist pharmacies.
Despite his confidence, to date not a single pharmacy has been opened in an Australian supermarket. The contrast is stark with what's unfolded, for example, in the US.
The drugstore became, in the 1950s and 60s, drastically changed when you had the growth of chain drugstores in the United States, companies like Walgreens. So they came to dominate the drug trade, in a sense, after the 1960s, after the, you might say, the shift of population to the suburbs, and that's where the chain drugstores were. And they slowly started putting the small drugstore pharmacy owners out of business, so that by the 1970s, the number of independent shops was dropping drastically. And then in the late 1970s and the early 80s, you had the growth of what we call in America big box stores, Walmart, Costco, Kmart, and these very large stores had pharmacies in them and, again, had huge impact, especially in rural areas where Walmart would commonly put the small pharmacy owners, like my father's shop, out of business. The big box stores saw pharmacy as a lost leader, as something they could lose money on just to pull people into the shop. And so the independent little store owners couldn't compete. And so that also had a huge impact in the United States from the 1980s to the present. If you're measuring it by dollar volume, how much money is spent on medicines in the United States, it may be 3/4 of the prescription drug income. It comes in big box stores and in the chain stores. It's probably 80%, something like that.
Up to the 1930s, chemists compounded the medicines they sold to their customers, mixing them from ingredients they bought from drug companies, companies still around today like Merck or Eli Lilly. That was about to change as drug companies began making the single-dose tablets and ready-made medicines we see today.
The big change came in pharmacy when manufacturers, tablets and ointments entered the field in the 30s and 40s. And so the whole idea of compounding was suddenly almost irrelevant, because even though there are still pharmacists that do compounding these days, and it's still a widespread practice in the United States, for example, in Australia you had suddenly tablets that had been manufactured and were called ready prepared. Prior to the manufacture of tablets on a mass scale by corporate entities, no medications were ready prepared. Pharmacists made potions, pills, tablets, ointments, the whole gamut of things that were sold in pharmacy. They covered a whole range of other areas too in Australia, like veterinary products. That's not the case now, but it would be still the case in some remote locations in Australia.
After World War II, more change lay ahead for pharmacies. Universal public health became available in the UK with the establishment of the National Health Service, transforming the role and the income stream of the pharmacist, who was paid by the government to fill prescriptions.
Virtually overnight, the number of prescriptions being written by doctors and being presented at chemist shops virtually quadrupled. They went up from about 70 million prescriptions a year in about, I think it's 1947. Within a year or two, that had gone up to 240, 250 million. As you can imagine, the chemists were delighted with this, because it was quite a generous remuneration scheme at the time. And what happened was that, certainly in Britain, many of them expanded the dispensary at the back But the chemists themselves basically spent most of their day out of public sight. So the public perception of pharmacy diminished considerably because the only contact they had really was with the shop assistants and so on. We also get the rise of supermarkets, so there's increased competition there, the rise of self-service. So there are a lot of commercial and trading trends going on. It's the rise of the pharmacological revolution, lots of new drugs coming onto the market from manufacturers. And in Britain, that results in a crisis by the 1980s because governments have realized that the community pharmacists are not doing much other than dispensing prescriptions round the back. The result of that was an announcement by a minister in 1981 querying whether community pharmacy had a future. And that resulted in an inquiry. It's called the Nuffield Inquiry into Pharmacy, which published in 1986. And it's that really which is the turning point for pharmacy in the UK, where pharmacy essentially has to reinvent itself.
Here in Australia, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme was established after the Second World War. As in Britain, almost all pharmacists would ultimately stop compounding and start dispensing ready-made medication.
It wasn't too many years ago that the chemist shop was almost a place of reverence, a darkened cloister filled with pungent, mysterious odours and cluttered with odd-shaped bottles. The chemist himself was a man of respect, whose awe-inspiring skills kept him far removed from the rest of the commercial world. But commerce, it seems, is far more powerful than even the most potent prescription, and today's pharmacist is as brazenly commercial as the local supermarket.
Community pharmacists now operate under five-year agreements with the Australian government, the last of which was signed in the middle of last year.
It's worth $19 billion over 5 years. That's about 30% of PBS costs. I am Dr. Leslie Russell. I'm an adjunct associate professor at the Menzies Centre for Health Policy at the University of Sydney. That pays the pharmacists for dispensing PBS scripts. It also pays the wholesalers for delivering drugs to the pharmacists, but there's a significant amount of money, probably well over $1 billion, perhaps $1.3 or $1.5 billion, that goes to a number of pilots, research projects, things like home medication reviews, diabetes management, those sorts of things that go beyond just drugs themselves. And whilst I believe that's really a good idea, there is a problem, which is that a lot of these activities that pharmacists are paid for have very low uptake. They're not very well evaluated. They just get funded year after year because the pharmacists say, we want it. So some of us are quite critical about the level of transparency that's involved in these very large sums of money that are paid out by the government from taxpayer funds to pharmacy. The money that pharmacists get from the PBS is generally about 40% of their income. All the rest of their income comes from all the various things that you see in a pharmacy, everything from baby clothes to homeopathic medicines to Band-Aids. I understand why they feel they need to build up their profit margins, but I do think sometimes that makes it difficult for them to then turn around and say, and we want to be an important part of the primary care team, because there are certainly some people who would look askance at someone selling homeopathic medicines, perhaps.
Each agreement with the federal government locks in the double protection from competition.
That is written into every community pharmacy agreement. And I can tell you, as someone who's worked in politics, that the pharmacy people, Pharmacy Guild in particular, fight fiercely to keep those protections. The sorts of protections we're talking about are who can own a pharmacy. Only a pharmacist can own a pharmacy. That probably is sensible. Where pharmacies can be located, how many pharmacies in a given area. There's a big, big issue about whether or not pharmacies can be in supermarkets. I can tell you from my experience in the United States that being able to drop your prescription off, do your shopping, go back with your trolley and pick up your prescription is extraordinarily convenient. The pharmacists are currently opposed, and I think the doctors are opposed too, if the truth be known, to being able to get your prescription filled by a pharmacist located within a doctor's office. And if you think about it, that would make a big difference for many people who struggle to get to the doctor's office, for whom transport is not easy, but that cannot be done at the moment.
Patients could soon be visiting the pharmacy for a range of services they currently get from their GP. It's part of a multi-billion dollar five-year agreement the government's just signed with the Pharmacy Guild.
That means pharmacists could offer services like managing chronic conditions such as arthritis, treating wounds, and helping mental health patients manage their medications. Pharmacists say they're not trying to edge doctors out, but doctors' groups are angry.
Pharmacists are a very important part of the multidisciplinary aspects of medical care, but they are not doctors and they shouldn't try to be.
Yes, well, Kerry, of course, the role pharmacists now have in distribution of vaccines, it didn't just happen overnight. Pharmacists had to fight for this during the time that I was at the Pharmacy Guild, so pharmacists could get involved in the distribution of flu vax. And at the time, the doctors and the AMA were outraged and up in arms and considered that pharmacy was trying to muscle in on the GP's turf. They put out several missives at the time about how pharmacists wouldn't be able to handle anaphylactic shock in pharmacy from people who were getting the flu vax. But of course, this is and was nonsense, of course, because at the time in the United States, over 50 states had already authorised the provision of vaccine distribution to pharmacy as a main outlet for the provision of distribution of vaccines. In the end, a pharmacy became the place to go for flu vax, as well as GPs. And of course, with the incidence of COVID, pharmacy was well prepared to take a leading role.
Well over a million doses of COVID vaccine have now been given by community pharmacists in Australia. However, it's unlikely that the tension between doctors and pharmacists over who can provide which services will go away, or that the criticism of the protected status of Australia's pharmacists will disappear. My guests on this Rear Vision were Greg Higbee from the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Dr. Leslie Russell from the Menzies Centre for Health Policy at the University of Sydney, Stephen Greenwood, former Executive Director of the Pharmacy Guild of Australia, Stuart Anderson, Emeritus Professor in the History of Pharmacy at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and Associate Professor Rebecca Moles from the Sydney Pharmacy School at the University of Sydney. Russell Stapleton is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision. Bye from Kerry Phillips.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.